at rwjf.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, we're going to talk with a University of Florida professor who just won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, Looking at the History of the Gulf of Mexico. But first, there's a new proposal to fill a lagoon in North Tampa and build townhouses on the newly created land. The lagoon is in the Dana Shores area, just north of the east end of the Courtney Campbell Causeway. And joining us now are Allison Roberts, who's president of the Dana Shores Civic Association, and Kent Bailey, who's chair of the Tampa Bay Group of the Sierra Club. And we're going to talk about this Phil project. And Allison and Kent, welcome to WMNF. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming by. So, Allison, tell us, there's a proposal by a developer to fill in a lagoon. Is that right?
That is correct.
And where's the lagoon?
The lagoon is in Rocky Point. If you're coming across the causeway, many people are familiar with Bahama Breeze that's located there. It's on that side of Rocky Point, and it's just to the left of your car as you're driving into and going to Bahama Breeze.
It's a lagoon now. They want to fill it in with dirt and build townhouses. Is that right?
That is correct.
It seems so old school. That's what they did in the 50s and 40s, isn't it?
Well, I think that's what's working to their advantage, is it seems so hard for people to believe this would even be proposed in this day of age.
Is there wildlife in the lagoon? Do manatee come through, or stingrays?
There are. My husband and I went out there on our boat this past weekend. We had 5 manatee sightings in about an hour and a half. It was a manatee protection zone before it was acquired by the property owner. And we had another neighbor out there about 2 weeks ago that took video of a large congregation of manatee and their calves going through the area.
Hmm. How big is the area that they want to fill in with dirt?
The total cove is about 8 to 9 acres, and the area that they are proposing at this point to fill in is 3 acres.
And they're going to go soon to the Tampa City Council and ask for permission?
They're going next Thursday evening at 5 p.m. in front of Tampa City Council. And at that point, what they're asking for is to change the land use designation so that then they could move forward with the permitting process.
So I guess they can do this. They can even make this request because it's privately owned. The lagoon is privately owned, right? Or is that not true?
The submerged land is privately owned. So the waterways, they're our federal navigation, but the submerged land under the waterways is privately owned.
What's next to this area now?
On the uplands, we have post-Rocky Point apartments. We have Scarborough Park, which is used by the residents and homeowners and guests of Rocky Point Island. There is also an IBM building, and there is the DoubleTree.
Mm-hmm. So Scarborough Park, is that a private park?
It is a private park.
Yeah. Somebody's able to sell submerged land. I didn't even know that was possible. You can sell land that's underneath essentially an extension of Tampa Bay.
That's actually the shocking part about it. When you live in a community, you kind of assume that things are pretty stable around you. Back in the 50s and 60s, large areas of Tampa Bay were sold as submerged waterways to folks with private ownership. And today, still some of those areas exist. So for that reason, this is a pretty concerning matter, because it could set a precedent for those other privately owned submerged properties.
So, Allison Roberts, you're the president of the Dana Shores Civic Association. What do your fellow neighbors, what do your neighbors think about this? What does the Civic Association think about this?
Well, we may run a little bit differently than a lot of associations, because we try to look outside just our walls at the surrounding public areas. So based on that, and based on the egregiousness of this proposal, we're pretty concerned about it. We are located about a quarter mile away. What's really interesting is to watch the other communities that are even closer to this. Folks that live in post-Rocky Point, for instance, are really concerned about this. So it's bringing these neighborhoods together.
Well, that's Allison Roberts, who's president of the Dana Shores Civic Association. Also here is Kent Bailey, chair of the Tampa Bay Group of the Sierra Club. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org if you want to make a comment or ask a question. Kent, I didn't know that it was still legal to go out into Tampa Bay and fill in part of the waterway with dirt and then build a building on top of it.
It's pretty astonishing to think that something like that could happen in the 21st century. The Sierra Club's concern about this project focuses not only on the fact that here is a lagoon where taxpayers are spending more than $10 million to open up under the Courtney Campbell Causeway and get water circulating in this area, which will improve the ecology of that whole region, especially and in this lagoon also, so that while you have aquatic life there now, it's going to blossom as soon as this project is completed that will enable the water flow around above, north of Courtney Campbell Causeway. It's an impaired waterway right now, but we're fixing that.
So the state or county is already working on trying to improve the water quality, spending money, lots of public money to improve the water.
More than $10 million, right. And construction is underway. And then this is not a unique parcel. There are other parcels around the bay that are underwater, that are privately owned. If this goes forward, it will set the most dangerous precedent you can imagine for subsequent landowners to come forward and say, well, you allowed them to do that there. How can you not allow me to do this here? One of the areas that your listeners will probably recognize, along Bayshore, on the water side of the seawall, in the bay, a quarter mile stretch of privately owned property between Willow Avenue and almost all the way down to Rome.
Wait a minute, I thought all that land in next to Bayshore in Tampa, I thought that was all publicly owned. That part of the bay was publicly owned.
It's zoned RM24, just like this parcel. And if this parcel is permitted to be developed, there is no reason in the world why those homeowners who are living along that section of Bayshore won't eventually find themselves staring at rows of townhouses in front of them instead of the bay.
So, Kent, all around Florida, not just here in the Tampa Bay area, but all around Florida, Davis Islands, for instance, some of the developments off Clearwater. I mean, we have these developments where there was dredge and fill in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. People came in, they dredged land from the sea bottom, put that fill up on top of other land, and created places where we would now have suburbs, Davis Island being in Tampa being the best example of that. What's wrong with that? And Apollo Beach, I mean, we could go all over the Bay Area and point to places where this is happening in Arapeca and other places, but what's wrong with that?
Well, you know, it was in the 50s that carbon pollution exceeded 300 parts per million. We're now above 400 parts per million. And climbing, unfortunately. It had appeared to have leveled off for 3 years. Last year, it took another uptick. The Tampa Bay Regional Planning Council hosted a presentation by Dr. Tim Hall just last week, and he told them that 30 inches of sea level rise was not only possible, but very probable by the year 2060. 30 inches of sea level rise by the year 2060. We need to be moving people out of these coastal high hazard areas, not putting more people in there. We have a legacy now of very expensive homes, very nice homes. 50% of the population in Tampa Bay lives below 10 feet above sea level. Dr. Hall told people, told the Tampa Bay Regional Planning Council that there was a 1% chance in any given year that the Tampa Bay could be hit by a Category 4 storm that would bring 10-foot surge into Tampa Bay, wiping out 50% of our home stocks.
Well, we're going to take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. There's a proposal to fill a lagoon in North Tampa and build townhouses on the newly created land. The lagoon is in the Dana Shores area, just north of the east end of the Courtney Campbell Causeway. And with us are Allison Roberts, president of the Dana Shores Civic Association, and Kent Bailey, chair of the Tampa Bay Group of the Sierra Club. Our phone number again, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. And thanks to Patty Perkey and Frank Knox. They're both behind the scenes of making this happen. Let's go to Gary in Dunedin. Gary, what's your question for our guests?
Well, first of all, thank God that you're doing this to stop this. And I would like you to tell us, like, what is the most effective way, you know, other than joining up with you, maybe hiring a lawyer? Can we send money? Secondly, I can say this, and I'm sure you already know it. I was born and raised here. And when they made Island Estates, they ruined Clearwater Bay, and then it made Clearwater Beach not have clear water anymore. But this state has never cared about environmental quality, and you're right. If you don't stop this thing, then it's just the tip of the iceberg.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Gary, for your comments. Allison, what would you say to Gary?
Hey, Gary, thank you very much for your concern. We share it very deeply. We have worked with the folks over at Post Rocky Point Apartments, and they've set up a Facebook page called No Rocky Point Rezone. And if you sign up for that Facebook page, you'll find a few things there. You'll find information on that city council meeting next Thursday evening. I would encourage everyone to attend that meeting. You'll find information on how to email the city council members and the mayor, which gives them insight into your thoughts and feelings about the project. And third, you'll find a link to a GoFundMe page, which is Don't Take Away Our Waterways. We have hired an attorney so that we can be working with everyone here to bring these same concerns in front of city council.
Now, Kent, here's an email from Bowen. Bowen says, all the land along Coffee Pot Bayou in St. Pete is owned by the landowners across the street, also the property near the boat ramps on First Street in St. Petersburg. So it's not uncommon, I guess, as you said, for some of the submerged land, this land that's now, it looks to us like, water on the bay, to be owned by private property owners.
It really isn't. Some of your listeners may remember a few years ago, a proposal came forward to create a marine tourist trap, basically. I called it a dolphin prison at the time, right in the middle of Tampa, of Terra Sea Aquatic Preserve. And the idea was they were going to trade some submerged land there and with the state and put a little miniature marine land there, right where it currently exists a interstate rest area. It was eye-opening to me. That was the first that I had ever understood that you could own Bay Bottom. I always thought that navigable waters were owned by the taxpayers and belonged to everybody. I just want to underscore the idea. We have to get in touch with the city council. If you can't show up, call or email them. They need to hear from the community when this has to be stopped here.
Why aren't navigable waters owned by the taxpayers? Why can somebody who's in private business own navigable water?
Navigable waters is a very ambiguous term in general usage. There is a strict statutory definition that goes back to history, historic uses, and it's one of those situations where the strict legal definition is contrary to common sense.
All right. Here is Dr. Eli Rose from Dana Shores. Dr. Eli Rose, welcome to WMNF.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I think everything that has been said is wonderful, but they didn't hit on the major thing, which is the destruction of our environment. Dredge and fill was carried out to a great extent in the 50s and 60s until it was realized that our ecosystem and environment was being degraded. Seagrasses were being lost. Animals were dying out, fish population was decreasing, seabird rookeries were declining, and so finally the government decided that they should put a moratorium on dredging and filling. And over the last 50 years, thanks to organizations like Tampa Bay Watch who help improve the environment, we've seen the quality of our water come back so that seagrasses have returned, bird rookeries have increased, sea life has increased. And now we're looking to turn back to 50 years ago and tear apart everything that's been created in the last 50 years. And this is a real tragedy. We need to stop it before it gets any further.
Well, it sounds like, Eli, we haven't learned the lessons.
That's it. Most of us have. But, history tends to repeat itself, but people forget history. And Nathaniel Reed, who is a nationally renowned environmentalist, is quoted as saying, if you don't know your history, it's like walking into the middle of a movie. You don't know what's going on in the movie. And potentially that can happen here. Hopefully, Tampa City Council, in their wisdom, will be wise enough to stop this before it gains momentum.
All right, Eli, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Tom writes this about the situation filling in the Rocky Point Lagoon. He says, thanks for letting us know about this travesty. I cherish our water views like the Rocky Point Lagoon, and I'm sure homeowners or renters do too. We all pay for these views by subsidizing flood insurance to further build in flood-prone areas. Is sheer stupidity, writes Tom. I think people are pretty much agreed. I think people are just shocked that you can do this. I understand that they were able to do it in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, but now I think they're shocked that they would still be able to do it today. There's no law just saying when somebody applies for this permit, no. You know, shouldn't that be the way it is? Because we've learned so much about dredge and fill over the past 75 years.
I expect that you'll see some changes after this. I think with the public's involvement, you've seen folks like Commissioner Merman step up in the county right now, and she is working with the Planning Commission to try to do some things going forward that'll stop this in the county. In the city, this will remain an open issue until we take similar actions.
And Allison, it comes up to the Tampa City Council this Thursday. What time on Thursday?
At 5 p.m.
Okay, and so you're on the agenda for discussion?
Anyone can be on the agenda for the discussion. Get mm-hmm. there before 5 p.m. because I imagine seats will fill up fast, and sign up, and you'll have 3 minutes to talk.
Okay, let's take some more phone calls, and we're talking about a proposal to fill a lagoon, a water lagoon in North Tampa that is the site of some travel by manatee and other wildlife, and build townhouses on the newly created land that would be filled in with dirt. Let's go to Rita in Wesley Chapel. Hi, Rita, you're on. What do you think?
Yeah, hi. I've got a question. How much is the homeowner's insurance going to cost people that move there?
If you build a townhouse on it, how much will the townhouse association or the... Yeah, we don't know. It's got to be high, though, because it's not going to be that far off the surface of the water.
I'm in Western Pasco County, and mine is $1,500 a year.
You're flooded. Flood insurance?
Just regular homeowner's insurance. I don't even carry flood insurance. The final question is, and why will the bank write a mortgage on such a risky piece of property?
That's a good question.
The literature that I find most informative about those two issues comes out of the insurance industry and the banking industry. They are well aware of the fact that the sea level is rising and claims, as a matter of fact, are going up. They've had many, many, many more times claims of what's called nuisance flooding recently than in, say, 10 years ago. It is going to be the banks and the insurance companies that eventually put an end to this. Banks are going to refuse to make mortgages, and insurance companies are going to charge you so much you simply can't afford it. And if you're a homeowner who has a mortgage, you have to have insurance. It doesn't matter if you pay the principal and the interest and the property taxes. If you don't have an insurance policy, you are in default and you go into foreclosure just as surely as if you paid nothing whatsoever. This is a coming crisis in the Tampa Bay area. We are the most threatened city in America from surge, one of the 10 most threatened from sea level rise. We are headed for a real estate disaster. What we need to be doing is preparing to deal with sea level rise instead of pretending it just doesn't exist.
Right, right. I guess until the banks decide to do that, we need to call the city council and voice our opinion.
Call the city council and voice your opinion anyway, yes, about this and other things, because we need to be preparing our community to deal with what we know is coming. We need to be investing smartly, getting our infrastructure hardened to deal with the sea level rise that's coming, and just adopt the policies that are going to mitigate it. There's a lot that local government can do to reduce our contribution to carbon pollution in the atmosphere. We need to stop making the situation worse. We need to adopt policies that reduce carbon pollution, and we need to stop allowing people to build in areas where we know they're going to be threatened.
Hey, maybe the Tampa Bay Times could get a little bit more information in the paper and in the news showing people what's going to happen and when it's going to happen. I think a lot of people just are clueless.
All right, Rita, thanks a lot. Thanks,
okay,
thanks for your phone. Ken, do people want to find out more? Is there more on the Sierra Club webpage?
There is. You can simply Google Tampa Bay Sierra Club, and that'll get you right to us. And we are, if I may mention, we have a monthly meeting, the second Wednesday of every month at 6:30 at the Seminole Heights Library. That's at 4711 Central Avenue. We will not have a meeting there in July, but in August we have a very special program coming from Rise Above Plastics, who are going to tell us what we can do to curb the nearly 9 million tons of plastic that goes into our oceans each year and is added to the 3 million tons that's already there.
All right, we'll have to talk about that in a few weeks before that happens. And Allison Roberts, president of the Dana Shore Civic Association, you know, I got to say that I read a statement that you wrote about your concerns, your civic association, and your concerns about this dredge and fill operation. I thought it was really well argued. So can people see that online somewhere? What you wrote?
If they want to learn more about it one-on-one, they can email us at info@danashores.com, or for more complete information, going to that Facebook page. We'll keep them up to date. And again, that's the No Rocky Point Rezone Facebook page.
Okay, and the City Council is going to talk about it this coming Thursday at 5 o'clock, the Tampa City Council.
Correct, on the 28th.
All right. Allison Roberts, president of the Dana Shore Civic Association, and Kent Bailey, chair of the Tampa Bay Group of the Sierra Club. Thank you so much for coming by. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
And we will pay attention to what happens with this, because it's amazing to think that we would be doing this in this day and age, that we haven't learned from the history of the last 75 years.
It boggles the mind.
It does boggle the mind. Well, thanks for coming by. This is WMNF in Tampa. In a moment, we're going to talk more about the Gulf of Mexico, and we're going to talk about the history of the Gulf of Mexico and about dredge and fill operations around the Gulf. We're going to meet historian Jack E. Davis, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for his history of the Gulf of Mexico. This is WMNF in Tampa. Doors music from Oliver Mitsukudzi. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. In his new book, The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea, Jack Davis, a professor at the University of Florida, gives us a comprehensive look at the Gulf of Mexico from its geographic origins to the exploration by the first European explorers to the Deepwater Horizon disaster. For it, he won a Pulitzer Prize for history this year. And Jack Davis, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
My pleasure, Ron.
Thanks, Jack. So, Jack, why do we call it the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, it was a Spanish sea for some 300-plus years after the Europeans encountered the Gulf of Mexico for the first time. And so they were the first ones on the scene, and so they... of course, exercise their right to name the sea, the Gulf of Mexico.
Is it truly a gulf?
It is truly a gulf, and it is the largest gulf in the world, and the 10th largest saltwater body on the globe.
So if we were to go back to the 1500s and see the gulf as the native population did, what kind of things would the native population have seen? What would it have looked like back then? And how many native people were living along the Gulf from Mexico over to Florida?
Well, they would have seen those beautiful sunsets that we see from the Florida Gulf Coast. But they would have seen much more marine life in the water. And when the Europeans arrived, they described as the fish being so thick in the waters that they stopped vessels in their tracks. And so this was what natives saw. It's hard to say what the total population was of the indigenous peoples around the Gulf of Mexico before European contact, but certainly several hundred thousand more likely, and many of them, and some of them got all of their protein from the Gulf of Mexico, the Clusa in southwest Florida, for instance. 95% of their protein came from the estuarine environment. That's another thing. You know, what is now a growth coast in southwest Florida was very much a mangrove coast. And those mangroves are very important to giving birth to and protecting marine life, which attracts the bird life. They would have seen many more birds than what we see today. It was just ecologically a rich place. It still is. It's still one of the richest estuarine environments in the world, which is why it's so important to protect the Gulf of Mexico.
So you don't think that we've screwed it up really heavily? Let me just kind of jump way ahead in your book. Have we screwed it up too much, the Gulf?
I won't go so far as say too much, because there is a potential of restoring much of what we have lost. We screwed up a lot. There's no question about that, and we continue to do that as well. But at the same time, I try to leave my readers with a sense of hope, you know, a positive note. You know, it's very easy to write an environmental book that's all doom and gloom, and when you do, you're only speaking to the choir. And I think environmental writers such as myself and my good friend Cynthia Barnett, she struggles with this too. We need to speak, you know, we need to have a dialogue with those on the other side, the red, white, and blue Americans, if you will. And the reason why I say I have some hope is you remember, Rob, you've been around Tampa Bay for a long time. In the 1970s, beautiful Tampa Bay, one of the most productive estuaries on the Gulf of Mexico, was very close to becoming a dead body of water. And we got our act together, and this was true with bays and bayous around the Gulf Coast. We got our act together and brought those bays and bayous back to life, thanks to a lot of good-minded people at the local level, the state level, even the federal level. Thank goodness for the 1972 Clean Water Act and those countless unpaid volunteers and poorly paid staff of nonprofits.
Yeah, That's for sure. Well, Jackie Davis is our guest. Jack is a professor at the University of Florida. He's just written a book called The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. It came out last year, and it's out in paperback now, so I just written is the wrong way to say it. But Jack won the Pulitzer Prize last year for this book, the Pulitzer Prize in History. So tell me about the size of the native population compared to the size of the European explorers, because the European explorers noted something about the size of the native population that they came upon in the 15 and 1600s.
Yeah, and that speaks to the estuarine environment that I've been talking about. The Europeans who came from agrarian society were shocked to see how tall and physically robust the native peoples around the Gulf of Mexico were, you know, from South Florida to Mexico. And again, these people lived primarily on marine life. And they were very, very impressive. And if you read the documents from the exploration period, they are often described as giants. And, you know, but unfortunately, as tall and physically robust as they were, they were eventually wiped out by the Europeans, primarily by European diseases, because they did not have the immunities to such things as smallpox and the measles. That's the one great accomplishment from a European's perspective, of Hernando de Soto's 4-year ramble through the South. That is that he spread European diseases, and these native peoples died off and made it easier for Europeans to come back and settle those regions.
Well, you name and categorize all the famous Spanish explorers especially. What were the Spanish explorers looking for when they came to the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, initially gold and silver, and that's what Juan Ponce de Leon came to Florida for, not the Fountain of Youth. His contract with the king was to find gold, silver, and slaves. And let me tell you, the native peoples of Florida knew the Spanish were out there. Ponce didn't know about Florida. He stumbled upon it. He had a guess that there was some land up this way. He didn't know about the native peoples. He suspected there might be. But the native peoples knew the Spanish would reach them. These were seafaring people, the indigenous people. They got around. Word of mouth got around. They had this very sophisticated communication network. And they were prepared for him and others, and they ran him off twice. And the second time, they ended up shooting a dart that hit him in the thigh. It was a poison with the sap of the machineal tree, a Florida native. And a lot of people don't know this. He died from that. He was taken back to Cuba by his men, and he died of his wound.
Did they ever find gold?
No, they did. The only gold they found, well, of course, they found plenty in Mexico, but not in the current-day United States. No, they found nothing, except for maybe trinkets that Native peoples had that they had acquired through trade. And so eventually the Europeans gave up on trying to, after Soto, gave up on trying to find gold and silver, and decided they would turn what is today the current United States into some, their hope was to turn it into an agrarian empire and to extract the timber.
Some of those descriptions of native people who were come upon by the Spanish explorers, they perfect human specimens, or perfect physical specimens. I think that was nearly what they described the natives as. What did the Spanish explorers think of the food that the native population was eating?
Yeah, so here's the great irony. The Spanish more or less starved on the Gulf Coast, the Spanish explorers. I prefer to call them conquistadors, because that's really what they were. Exploration was just secondary to conquering. And of course, they were, again, exploring for gold and silver. But they starved on, and this seems very odd, because it didn't require much to reach down and grab some oysters. There are oyster beds all over the Gulf Coast, or, you know, and as we know, those of us from the Gulf Coast, mullet are always jumping. There were blue crabs available, stone crabs, but the conquistadors tended to be people from inland Spain, not coastal people. And so they weren't familiar with harvesting marine life. And there's one expedition, Panfilo de Navarrete's expedition, that was supposed to sail from Cuba to Mexico, but ended up in Tampa Bay. Excuse me. And that expedition reaching a point of starvation that they were killing their horses, slaughtering their horses as food, rather than reaching down into one of the bays and grabbing oysters. Or they stole from the Indians, and what they got from the native peoples were, of course, either oysters or a dried mullet or some sort of marine life.
Jack Davis is our guest. The book is The Gulf, The Making of an American Seas. So I still want to stick with Native Americans for just a moment, and that is they built these shell mounds that were part of the physical landscape. They were giant, right? What was the significance of the shell mounds that they were building? What was the purpose?
Well, there were three principal types. There were burial mounds. There were refuse mounds, which we call kitchen middens today. And there were ceremonial mounds, and these mounds were built primarily of shell and but all other sorts of marine life refuse. And this is another thing that impressed the Europeans is that these, in fact, one observer called the Gulf of Mexico an oyster kingdom or a shell kingdom because. These mounds circled the Gulf of Mexico, and some people built their huts on top of them to keep them high above them. Sorry about that, Rob.
That's okay. I love dogs.
That was my Rottweiler.
He wants to add something to the conversation.
And yes, that's exactly right. I think that's her comment about the European invasion, I suppose.
But did they live on top of the shell mound, or was it a way to escape from the hurricane? And in addition to, you know, using them as burial mounds or also as places where they're depositing the shells of the oysters that they ate, was there another purpose to these mounds?
No, those three reasons. And... Now, the other thing that they did do with shells, at least Southwest Florida Indians, is they used conch shells to build seawalls and to create these water courts in places where they lived. And again, as I said, in some cases they built on top of them, lived on top of them to keep them above the storm surge, also to keep them where there might be better breezes, to keep the the bugs that we're all familiar with, the mosquitoes and the midges at bay.
The midges being the no-see-ums.
That's right, what we call the no-see-ums.
Yeah. Yeah. When was oil discovered in the Gulf of Mexico area?
Oil was discovered right at the turn of the 20th century at Spindletop in Texas, and it's just a few miles inland. And eventually, the industry made its way toward the water. In the early 20th century, in the 1910s, began sinking their first what they called then over water. Oil wells, and usually just a few feet off the coast. But the first oil well that was sunk out of sight of land in the Gulf of Mexico, in the United States, in the world, was off the coast of Louisiana in 1947. And one thing that I found interesting about that oil industry is this connection, direct connection between Jimmy Stewart, the actor, and that first oil well. He made a movie in 1953, 6 years after that oil well was sunk, titled Thunder Bay, a more forgettable movie of his, loosely based on the sinking of that oil well.
Mm. So Louisiana has really paid a price for its connection to the oil industry. Talk about that. What price has Louisiana paid for that connection?
Boy, you're right. It really has. It's primarily the price it has paid is in the 10,000 miles of oil industry canals that crisscross the coastal marshes of Louisiana. And Louisiana has the most impressive coastal marshes in the country, the greatest square mileage of coastal marshes. And this is a marvelous, again, estuarine environment. And those 10,000 miles of oil industry canals, which are used for primarily for running the pipelines from the offshore oil and gas rigs to the inshore facilities, are contributing significantly to the coastal erosion of Louisiana. That, along with the damming and diking of the Mississippi River. So as a consequence, Louisiana is losing anywhere from 25 to 35 square miles of land a year. So it's, to put it another way, Louisiana is the only state in the country that's shrinking. It's growing smaller in size.
25 to 35 square miles a year. What impact does that have on hurricanes?
Well, it has a number of impacts. So here's one. One, obviously, when you reduce the size of the estuarine environment, you have less sea life, right? But you also have less carbon absorption when you're destroying those estuarine environments because they are carbon sinks. And the other thing is you destroy an important buffer against hurricanes or any sort of intense weather. And the irony here is that scientists and even politicians have known that these coastal marshes are buffers against storms. They've known that since the 19th century, yet we've been destroying these regions ever since.
Jack, the damming and diking of the Mississippi River, it's interesting because I didn't know what effect it had on the flow of the Mississippi. Let's start with how much sediment flows down the Mississippi every year?
You know, I don't recall the exact number, but it's megatons, and that sediment plays an important geographic, geological purpose because the Louisiana, okay, if we removed all the engineering structures from the Gulf of Mexico, the Louisiana coast is a naturally eroding coast on its own. But the sediment, the importance that it played is that it replenished that coast, even built up that coast every year. But now we have built dikes up and down the Mississippi River that together are twice as long as the river itself, and that has accelerated the flow of the Mississippi River. And so consequently, that accelerated speed of the water sends much of the sediment out into the middle of the Gulf of Mexico rather than allowing it to swing around and replenish the Louisiana coast.
So the delta is not being rebuilt by the sediment from the Mississippi like nature intended.
That's exactly right. And, you know, Rob, that's true everywhere on the Gulf Coast. It's true in Florida. 85% of our beach erosion that we taxpayers end up paying for by replenishing these beaches, which is, you know, very important to our economy. So anybody can understand the need to have those beaches. But it's engineering projects around the Gulf of Mexico and the Florida coast that is responsible, you know, bridges, bayous, jetties, dredged bay bottoms, dredged canals and channels. That's what's washing away the majority of our priceless beaches in Florida.
We're talking with Jack Davis. His book, The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea, won the Pulitzer Prize for History, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Jack, we're probably the only, we have what I think is politely called industrial rivers. We've got the Fenn Holloway River here in Florida. It's designated as an industrial river. What does that mean?
Well, it was originally designated an industrial river in the late 1940s to try to lure Procter & Gamble to build a cellulose plant along on the river, in which ultimately the state did succeed in luring the plant, and it did provide some decent jobs for the people of Taylor County. But as an industrial river, Procter & Gamble and its successors at that plant were allowed to pollute that river at will. Essentially just turn it in, in fact, turn it into a wastewater discharge. And it killed that river. There's hardly anything that can live in it. It's created a miniature dead zone at the end of that river. Thanks to a lot of hard-working local people in Taylor County and other conservationists/environmentalists, public-minded people, the river was redesignated to protect it. Yet it still continues to be polluted. I took a toxic tour, as my host calls it, of the river when I was researching the book. And so 26 miles along that river from the plant, the cellulose plant, Buckeye, it's called, down to the Gulf of Mexico, that river stinks.
It flows into the big...
It's hard to get even close to it.
Flows into the Big Bend area? Is that where it flows into?
That's exactly right. The Big Bend area is somewhat like the Louisiana coast because much of it's coastal marshes. In the northern part of the Gulf, according to some studies, some 85% of the fish life spend part of their life in those Big Bend estuaries.
You know, just reading your book makes me wonder what the fishing would be like if we didn't do all this to the Gulf of Mexico. I wonder, practically with every page, I wonder. One of the points you make in your book is that tarpon fishing, though, actually led to some of the damage we see around the Gulf of Mexico. How did tarpon fishing and the sport of tarpon fishing lead to that damage?
Well, so tarpon fishing, as I point out in my book, tarpon fishing is where our tourism really begins, not with the beaches, but with the first tarpon that was hooked by a sport fisherman in 1885 down by Sanibel, and that set the sport fishing community on fire, and people converged on the south. Men and women coming from the Midwest, Northeast, and the British Isles for an opportunity to catch a tarpon, not just a tarpon, many tarpon. This wonderful fighting fish is, I write in the book, it's like, because you can catch them in the inland waters, in those days they were easily more than 150 pounds, and you could catch a couple of dozen in 2 weeks. But ultimately what we ended up doing is, by the turn of the century, the tarpon population is on the verge of collapse. This is also the beginning of at least offshore conservation in Florida, because many people recognized what was happening, and they said, we've got to do something about this. And so they adopted a practice of catch and release. Now, not everybody practiced catch and release, but there were many were, and that's what we... that's what's in place today, and that's supposed to be the practice of tarpon fishing, both on the Texas Gulf Coast and the Florida Gulf Coast.
But how did it lead? It brought tourists here.
The railroad. When you bring tourists, where you're going to get? You're going to get development. And so that's when you started getting, that's when Florida and Texas as well, because those were the primary tarpon fishing areas. And of course, Texans said their tarpon were bigger than anybody else's. But that's when you start seeing these big hotels going up to attract these tarpon fishers. And you bring all these tarpon fishers down to Florida and Texas, and they start discovering the beaches. And they say, hey, if we're not catching tarpon, we can also hang out on the beach. And of course, this is really the beginning of significant growth along the Gulf Coast.
We have a lot of phosphate mining here in the Tampa Bay area, but it comes back to haunt our neighbors in the northern part of the Gulf.
Yeah, isn't it another irony, another connection? That's what I look for as a historian, environmental historian, is connections. And here's another one. The Gulf of Mexico dead zone that we're all familiar with, can reach the size in the summer times, the size of the state of Delaware, and in particular summers, even the size of the state of Connecticut. And what's responsible for the dead zone is Midwestern agriculture and runoff from agriculture. There are a lot of responsible farmers and ranchers around the country, some of them not so careful as others. So as a consequence, we have tons of agricultural runoff coming down the Mississippi River and creating that dead zone. Well, what's fertilizing those fields up in the Midwest? Our breadbasket. It's fertilizer, and so much of the phosphate that is mined around the Tampa Bay area, which has had its impact on the bay and of course the rivers and streams around Tampa Bay area, not like it did in the 1970s, but in any case, much of the phosphate that's mined around the Tampa Bay area ends up in the Midwest on those agricultural lands and ends up washing down these streams and rivers and into the Mississippi and back down to the Gulf of Mexico.
And creating that giant dead zone. Jack, I don't...
very much so to that giant dead zone.
We didn't get to a lot of topics in your book, which is really a great history of the Gulf of Mexico. But over and over again, is it fair to say that you think that there's a big payback if we learn to live and coexist with the Gulf as opposed to those of us that try to dominate it and change it?
Absolutely. Again, the Gulf is one of the richest estuarine environments in the world. It's produced one of the most productive commercial fisheries in the country, in some years outperforming the entire East Coast. It's produced $1 billion sport fishing industry. As long as we're destroying those estuaries, we're having an impact on ourselves, and it doesn't require much, Rob, for us to protect the Gulf of Mexico and its natural endowments. And what it requires is just a respect for what makes it a living, giving sea. Nature gives back so much more when we leave it alone than it does when we try, of course, when we diminish it, but it also when we try to manage it, it doesn't do as well. And all we have to do is recognize that, and we recognize that with our bays and bayous and bringing them back to life. So it's very possible to live in a stable relationship with the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, Jack, congratulations on the book. In the first half hour on this show, we were talking about a new proposal for another dredge and fill operation here in Tampa, and I thought, the folks who are proposing the dredge and fill ought to read your book because, I mean, there is big payback if we treat the Gulf right.
Huge payback, and dredge and we should be beyond, Rob, we should be beyond the dredge and fill era. It should not even be on the table. It's destructive to existing marine life and estuaries. But also, we're dealing with sea level rise, and we don't need concrete seawalls. Our best defense against sea level rise is not diesel pumps. It is not concrete seawalls. It is the living shoreline, and we should be doing everything we can to restore the living shoreline, those mangroves, those coastal marshes, those oyster beds.
Jack Davis, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. Great to have you here. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks, Rob. Very much appreciate it.
Thanks, Jack. That's Jack Davis, who's a professor at the University of Florida in Gainesville. He won the Pulitzer Prize this year for his book, The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea, and that book is now out in paperback. You're listening to WMNF.